AI really in healthcare is playing four roles. One is it's improving health for patients, such as better clinical outcomes. The second is improving healthcare experience, including faster access to clinicians. The third is improving healthcare delivery, so just lowering costs of delivering care, improving productivity. And then the fourth is supporting healthcare workers. You know, we have huge shortages of clinicians throughout this country. Clinical medicine is getting harder and harder, and there's a lot of burnout. So AI can help to support our existing teams.
You're listening to the Pain Matters Podcast, presented by the American Academy of Pain Medicine, the nation's leading podcast for healthcare providers, focused on providing the best care today, tomorrow, and beyond. Each episode, we'll share the latest innovations and practical applications that directly impact how we care for patients and measure success in multidisciplinary care. Let's get started.
Welcome to the beginning of our multi-part Artificial Intelligence in Medicine series. Today, we welcome two internationally recognized AI experts to our show.
Dr. Tinglong Dai is the Bernard T. Ferrari Professor at the Johns Hopkins Carey Business School. He is the co-chair of the Johns Hopkins Workgroup on Artificial Intelligence in Healthcare, a part of the Hopkins Business of Health Initiative, a collaboration between the Johns Hopkins Business School, the Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, and the Hopkins School of Medicine. He is vice president at the Institute for Operations Research and the Management Sciences. Dr. Dai has been quoted hundreds of times in the media, including Bloomberg, CNN, Fortune, The New York Times, NPR, USA Today, The Wall Street Journal, and The Washington Post. Plus, he has appeared on national and international television, such as CNBC and PBS NewsHour. In 2021, Dr. Dai was named one of the world's best 40 under 40 business school professors by Poets and Quants. I can definitely attest to his teaching excellence myself, as I actually took two of Professor Dai's classes at Hopkins, and he's been a mentor to me on everything AI ever since.
We're also honored to bring on Dr. Nestoris Mathiudakis, who is an associate professor of medicine at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, where he has joint appointments in endocrinology, diabetes, and metabolism, as well as biomedical informatics and data science. He is currently the co-director of the Diabetes Prevention and Education Program and course director of the medical school's clinical informatics course for first-year medical students. His work focuses on medical applications of generative AI, and we can't wait to talk to him about this today.
The first 15 minutes or so of this podcast are going to be a little bit more dense than the rest of it because we have to get through some basics and terms in order to set the stage and foundation for the rest of our discussion. Follow along. I promise it's worth it.
Tinglong, you recently gave a talk in which you shared a quote from the CEO of Google, Sundar Pichai. He said that AI is more important than fire and electricity. AI is everywhere in healthcare, but still, that is a pretty bold statement. Give me your take on this quote and shed light for us on some exciting AI applications in healthcare.
First of all, thank you for having me. Just like fire and electricity, AI is a general purpose technology. It is essential. Like for every parent, your children are essential to you. Well, they were not essential before they were born, but once you have them, there's no come back, and they are essential to your life, right? So think about electricity. For centuries, we humans as a species, we were okay. But once we had electricity, there's no going back. And as a society, we cannot even function without electricity. The other dimension is that just like a fire and electricity, AI can be very, very dangerous.
Here we're talking about technology that can accelerate human discovery and innovation at speeds that, you know, are unimaginable. Maybe will allow us to solve complex global problems that will benefit all of humanity. For example, renewable energy, maybe even predicting pandemics in the future, and enhancing human capabilities in ways that we really can't even predict at this point. But, you know, you could argue that fire and electricity serve more basic human needs, right? Like warmth and light and energy. They're just essential to survive. And without them, we would not have AI. Clearly, you know, I'm a huge enthusiast for AI technology, and I think we are living in a pivotal moment in time. But it's hard to answer objectively whether that's on the same order of fire and electricity. AI really in healthcare is playing four roles. One is it's improving health for patients, such as better clinical outcomes. The second is improving healthcare experience, including faster access to clinicians. The third is improving healthcare delivery, so just lowering costs of delivering care, improving productivity. And then the fourth is supporting healthcare workers. You know, we have huge shortages of clinicians throughout this country. Clinical medicine is getting harder and harder, and there's a lot of burnout. So AI can help to support our existing teams. I think what's most exciting in these four aims is AI's role in improving health, first and foremost. And so some of the areas that I think are really exciting are in drug discovery, right? And so AI technology and helping to predict, chemical structures or molecules that might have biological activity as, you know, molecular targets for certain diseases, and the potential for us to advance the treatment of existing conditions, as well as, you know, maybe even solving cures for disease like cancer. And then the other area that I think is really exciting and already being used is in decision support. So one example is gastroenterologists who use AI-assisted endoscopic tools to identify lesions in the colon that might be suspect and need to be biopsied, and to ensure sort of a standard approach to care. And there's already been demonstration of improvements in clinical outcomes. And there's multiple examples throughout medicine and cardiology, for example, AI being used to identify vulnerable plaque and, reducing the cardiologist's variability in the procedure and increasing their accuracy. But there are in 2023, there were 5,000 articles published in PubMed on AI. So huge explosion in all domains of medicine. And it's really exciting to see where we're going to head in the coming years.
Ness, I know that your focus is generative AI. That's really exciting, but we can't get there until we understand machine learning and really the basic principles. So machine learning and deep learning, they are both under this umbrella of AI, but they are very different. They're not interchangeable. I see them as subsets of each other, kind of like those Russian dolls that nest inside each other. And AI, you can imagine, is kind of being the biggest doll. And inside the AI doll, if you open that up, is the machine learning doll. And then if you open the ML doll, you find the smallest doll, which is deep learning. But take us a little further. What is AI? What is machine learning? And what is deep learning?
Sure. Yeah, I really like that Russian doll analogy. I think it's, we're kind of going deeper and deeper within each of these categories. So starting most broadly, AI or artificial intelligence is a broad field. Essentially refers to anything related to making machines smart, performing tasks that we would think of as normally requiring human intelligence. And then machine learning is a subset of AI where systems or computers can learn by themselves rather than being programmed with specific rules. And then going a little deeper within that domain is deep learning, where these are essentially machine learning models that are built on deep neural networks resembling the structure and function of the human brain to detect patterns with very minimal human involvement. And so there's, within each of these domains, there's various techniques, each that are designed to answer specific types of problems or use specific data. And we're seeing applications of all of these in clinical medicine today.
Can you explain to me the concept of deep neural networks?
Yeah. So basically they can look at, the cat or dog or the MRI images and come up with the patterns and what is common. And it doesn't have to be linear. It can be non-linear, the relationships, and it can be multiple relationships, and they can kind of cluster those together.
Absolutely.
And just a comment that deep neural networks are being used everywhere. We're this is in modern society in ways we may not appreciate, tagging of a photo on your photo stream of a person, so recognizing their face, our voice assistants like Siri and Alexa and Google, even like recommendation systems like Netflix, like knowing what you're going to watch next, and self-driving vehicles. All of these are using deep learning to kind of process vast amounts of data and figure out patterns and make decisions around them using sort of less structured data. Like as Tinglong said, we're not talking about numbers and tables.
Would you say that there's a little less transparency when you're using deep learning versus linear regression?
Yes, I would, because you can't, in a linear regression, say, model, you can actually write out an equation, right? So the prediction of somebody's, blood pressure as the dependent variable in relation to, say, their age or whether they have diabetes and other factors can actually be completely spelled out. And you can then plug and chug into that equation to figure out the outcome, the predicted outcome for another patient, in ways that we really can't do with any of these models. You can't really tell the user exactly how it is that it figured out that the person that we're looking at in this image is this famous celebrity.
Yeah, it's just like the human mind. You know, everyone exactly. has their own ways of thinking. There are all these complex layers that interact to come up with a conclusion. And you can't really go back and say, even a human being can't tell you exactly how they came up with a conclusion or how their brain came up with all these patterns. And that's really the essence of deep mm-hmm. learning.
Yeah, I think it's very true.
Let's talk about the data required for AI. So there's training data, there's validation data, and test data. What are these things and where do they come from?
Sure. Yeah. So this is something that I've done a lot of work with in my career. So I do a lot of machine learning based predictive analytics using electronic health record data. And it involves these various data sets. So we start off with a training set, which is usually the largest portion of your data. And it's what you use to train the model. And you can think of this kind of like the textbook that a student is going to use to like prepare for an exam. So at this stage, you've got your training set, you have a model that is learning patterns or relationships from the features in this data set, and you're adjusting the parameters of the model based on these given inputs and expected outputs. In the validation set, often we'll do what's like a split sample. So a portion of it, say 70%, is used to train, 30% is used to validate. This is a step where we're fine-tuning the model's parameters and evaluating how it performs on data that it hasn't seen yet. And so this prevents this concept of overfitting, where a model trains too well on the data or learns too well on the data it's been trained with. And so it helps us to kind of ensure that the model will generalize well to new or unseen data in the future. And then a test set is used after the model's been fully trained and validated. And it's kind of like the final exam that the student is going to take to evaluate the model's performance. And this can be data from like a different health system, a different region of the country, a different country altogether. And ideally, we want a model to generalize well in the target population, which is the population that is the test set itself. So, in short, we're the training set is the original portion of the data that's developing the model. The validation set is fine tuning the model. And then the test set is this unseen data that is evaluating the model's performance.
We know that AI, it's really only as good as the data. So dumping bad data into an AI system will absolutely just derail its potential. It's garbage in, garbage out in that situation, right? So the data needs to have integrity. If you pull data from an electronic health record, for instance, it needs to be accurate. The records can't be sloppy. And this is actually very tricky in our specialty of pain medicine, where most of our outcomes are subjective and patient reported. So for instance, let's just look at the pain scale. A 5 out of 10 on a pain scale might mean one thing to you, another to me, another to Tinglong, and something else to Mustafa. And we all have these different life experiences that inform our understanding of that number. So let's talk a little bit about data integrity.
Yeah, this is such a fundamental concept in machine learning research. And often the data that we're using for machine learning is data that is acquired like retrospectively from real world clinical care, which is not, you know, it's not neat, as you said. These are clinicians are entering data into the EMR in different ways. Unlike clinical trials or prospective studies where we are collecting the same information at the same time in the same way for all the participants moving forward. So this does create some challenges in, you know, related to accuracy and consistency and reliability of data. So there's a couple aspects of data integrity, I think, as far as machine learning is concerned. The first is accuracy. So your data really do need to represent the real world condition that is you're trying to capture in the model. And that can be quite hard to prove. And so a lot of the work that we've done in the EMR really requires a lot of extensive pre-processing and validation to make sure that we're confident that when we say this variable means this medication at this dose, that it is true across all settings, say in a health system. And consistency, which is that we're maintaining the data in the same format and structure in the data set. And I'll give you an example in clinical medicine and sort of lab data. One thing that we use often for prediction is kidney function. And there's a lab, the estimated GFR, and laboratories can report that result in various different ways. They might give you a result with like greater than 60 as the upper limit of normal or the actual value. And so if you have a data set that is reporting numerical data inconsistently, it can really make it difficult to train the model. Completeness is a big problem. So we don't collect variables in the same way in clinical care. So we have major gaps in a variable that you think is predictive. It can lead to inaccurate predictions. Reliability, that we can consistently produce the same results under the same conditions. And then finally, timeliness of data. And so any of the work we're doing in AI in clinical medicine needs to keep up with current clinical care. And it's you can imagine that as clinical practice guidelines change and new medications come out and there's new treatments for certain conditions, that models could quickly become outdated and they would need to be maintained and updated to reflect that. One of the things you mentioned in pain medicine was like the pain score being, a subjective measure. And there's examples of that throughout medicine of things that are self-reported, and that whenever we're using something that has some subjectivity to it, it raises the possibility that that variability between different patients is going to introduce bias in the model's interpretation. So, for example, if like certain types of patients consistently report lower pain scores, right, for cultural reasons or fear of being like stigmatized as like potential opiate users or seekers, the AI model might actually infer that those patients require less pain management and then could make predictions that result in unfair treatment recommendations for those patients. And then if the clinician is like uniformly following the recommendation of the AI algorithm, you can see how we could quickly go down the slippery slope and actually exacerbate bias. So data integrity is key to all of the inferences that are being made in machine learning and AI algorithms.
That is such an important point, definitely in pain medicine, you know, where we have significant disparities and known treatment biases, like you said. And also, you know, the data in our world isn't really always reported the same way in databases. So, for instance, you know, we have company databases, and we have to be sure that the patients are feeding that information, their outcomes, into the databases or the systems in the same consistent way. So the patient has to be reporting that information, right? It can't go through a rep, it can't go through someone else and make its way into the database. So that you know, plays into data integrity and could potentially cause biases as well. But beyond this, what makes data good? It would be great if we were using functional MRI and biomarkers and these things all the time, more objective measures in pain medicine, but that's not really part of our daily clinical practice. That's a part of clinical trials.
I'm wondering if there's tiers to AI models as well, based on how they collect data? Is there models that actually do collect data prospectively that can be, you know, trained better than retrospective collection?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I believe that, and you know, if you look at the entire landscape, the majority of studies in this area are leveraging retrospective data that are already labeled for the machine to learn from, because it's so, you know, a big limiting factor in this area is having enough people to label the outcome correctly, right? If you've got clinicians reviewing pathology slides or images, yes, conducting it prospectively might ensure, you know, consistency and quality of the data because everybody is trained to do it in the same way and enter the results. But the downside of that is it's going to take time to accrue that volume of data needed to develop your model. To your comment about, like, are there ways to kind of critically appraise different AI tools? The FDA actually has some guidance documents on good machine learning practices, and there are now an emerging number of consensus guidelines on, like, what are the standards to ensure that any AI developed tool has met the minimum requirements for rigorous scientific evaluation. And medical journals are now, like, requiring that those checklists be added when you're submitting a publication for review.
I think one way to think about this is in terms of going back to that concept of real world validation, right? You could use a retrospective data set to figure out what the algorithms might be, and then sort of test them going forward on a prospective data set evaluating a similar population, which is actually what we're doing in our study that, you know, Tinglong and I are working on right now. But that's one way, maybe. Ness, what are your thoughts?
Oh, Hunter. So that's a slightly different and more advanced step of the whole process. So it's been estimated that, like, fewer than 5% of all AI developed algorithms have actually been prospectively evaluated, like, in clinical care on the outcome that they're intended to improve. We're just now starting to get to a point where we're seeing things being evaluated and demonstrating clinical outcomes and getting FDA approval.
And Tinglong, can you get into a little bit about the challenges with, you know, real world validation?
I mean, first of all, as Ness mentioned, it's very expensive and it take a long time. That's why most AI models are never validated. But validation is essential to ensure that people trust these models, trust their real-world performance. You know, there's a phrase in data science that if you torture the data long enough, it will confess to anything, right? That's absolutely true for deep learning models because they're so complex. It's just like you train a student who do very well in the practice exam, but they cannot do really well in the final exam. How do you expose your machine learning model, your AI models to the kind of challenges that really stick? That's very expensive. So that's why it's far easier to expose them to retrospective data. We know that FDA has approved almost 700 AI devices for clinical use, but most of them it's very hard to assess because the approval summary essentially only touches upon the retrospective performance. They say very little about real-world evidence because of lack of real-world validation. We need to have more real-world validation for clinicians to have confidence about such models' real-world performance.
Absolutely agree that this is a big gap. And, you know, the FDA has weighed in on this, like, post-market performance. You know, how does it deploy when it's, like, approved? But then how good is it at maintaining its performance over time? And like, how, and continuously adapting as care is changing, right? And the inputs would need to be adapted. And what is it that the FDA has actually approved? If the model, like, evolves so much over time, is it something different? When does it become something different? I mean, all of these questions are, I think, going to be fleshed out in the coming years, but the FDA has kind of weighed in on that with this It's like this continuous learning cycle, the total life cycle of the product, and having measures in place up front to say, all right, well, make sure that you do the due diligence after this is deployed clinically to maintain it and continue to evaluate and update it.
That's an important point. So let's talk about that real quickly, the updating. So I feel like, you know, systems where, let's say you went through fellowship, Mustafa, I'm going to talk to you in this situation. Next year, you're going to do your pain fellowship and you're going to learn a ton during that year. And then at the end of your pain fellowship, let's say you go into practice somewhere and then you never open another journal, you never open another textbook, you've stopped learning, right? So you're only as good as that fellowship year, but medicine is rapidly changing and rapidly expanding. So AI has this feature where it keeps learning.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's the most exciting aspect of artificial intelligence is that it is leveraging all human knowledge up to a point. I mean, at least all the human knowledge that it had available when it was trained in ways that are just completely, you know, impractical or impossible for a human being to do. Like, no matter, even if I allocated an hour and a half every day at the end of my workday to read PubMed articles in my field, there is absolutely no way that I could keep up with current knowledge in diabetes. There, you know, so the advantages is the speed at which it can kind of read all of those, all of the medical knowledge. But there are some concerns too in that not all medical publications or studies are equal, right? And we know that, you know, with increasing like predatory journals where you can kind of like pay to get your paper published, even if it's really low quality science, like would an AI model be able to distinguish between that type of study versus something published in the New England Journal of Medicine or JAMA? And that's very high quality medical research. Can the AI model really distinguish between science that is peer reviewed publication versus information that is getting from the internet at large, or just like social media or web pages? So what is fact? And, you know, now we're aggregating all of this information across multiple domains to make recommendations. And that, you know, that's just something that we're going to need to be really mindful of when we evaluate, interpret these recommendations and continue to evaluate AI decisions in clinical care.
And that really gets into this high profile New York Times lawsuit against OpenAI and Microsoft for copyright infringement. According to the Times, millions of its articles were used to train chatbots that are now competing with it, actually, as reliable sources of information. We know that the New York Times does tons of fact-checking, et cetera. The newspaper wants them to actually destroy any chatbot models and training data that are using this copyrighted material from the New York Times. Why is this lawsuit so important? What are its implications? And what does it actually mean for healthcare?
Yeah, it's a really important lawsuit. So this, again, New York Times filed it against OpenAI and Microsoft. And I think this issue touches on several critical problems. This is the intersection of intellectual property law, technological innovation, and who has the right to access and use information. And, you know, one of the reasons why I think ChatGPT has been so effective is that it is leveraging such a huge, diverse and extensive data set. And that is like information from news articles, including the New York Times, books, websites, PubMed. And you can imagine that if you curtail the data access of OpenAI because of these copyright restrictions, it could have implications on the AI's ability to generate, you know, human-like text and, you know, have meaningful outputs that which would impact its adoption. At the same time, you know, this is a journal that a newspaper that has the right to the property of the writing. And so like I think that the outcome of this trial will have, you know, potentially profound implications on the broader debate of how we use data for AI. If the ruling sort of is in favor of the New York Times, and there are now going to be restrictions placed on what data can be accessed for training, there may be a deceleration a little bit in medical research if AI can't access all of the information at hand. So if this extends, for example, to say, should AI, OpenAI, have access to all PubMed journals, or do they need to have like a subscription to the journal to read the data in those papers? You can imagine that that would have implications on how well it performs. I think it also brings up the point of like the quality and reliability of the information, right? This is a newspaper. This is not a peer-reviewed study. It is using the information to give recommendations. So how do we know what source was used to give a certain recommendation from ChatGPT? I think is another aspect sort of related to this. But it's, you know, it's a really fascinating case. And I think the outcome could either unlock or kind of restrict AI's potential to advance medical research.
High quality information tends to be very expensive, right? These days, a lot of articles are behind the paywalls and they're not cheap. They tend to be very expensive, whereas misinformation tends to be very affordable. Oftentimes they are free. And so when you crowd out the valuable information from the training data set, you end up having AI models that are built upon less valuable, tend to be messy, if not misleading information. So when the misinformation and disinformation become part of the training data set, we end up having worse AI models.
Tinglong, you and Shravani are currently working on a grant application involving generative AI. And Ness, this is an area of focus for you as well. So what is generative AI? How does it differ from predictive AI? We have heard about it in relation to ChatGPT, but define it for us and tell us about potential applications in healthcare.
It's all in the title, generative AI. So the generative part really is referring to creation of new content. There's new content, new data, new predictions based on learned information. So this is a subset of AI where we're actually creating things like novel images, text, audio, or other forms of data after training on a data set. And this, you know, has opened up a wider array of applications in various fields, including healthcare. And some examples of AI in healthcare, even in the context of my field in diabetes, are at the point of care for clinicians and sort of helping with clinical documentation, sort of producing clinical notes. In our health system, I just noticed this on our mobile app for Epic, there is now like a little icon for audio recording of the encounter. I mean, it's not yet being used, but with the patient's consent, you can record the entire encounter and then it will generate a clinical note from your discussion. And so that can really like cut down the burden of clinical documentation. It's being used to help for filling out forms for insurance reimbursement, which is the bane of all clinicians' existence right now. And it has potential to assist with clinical decision support in synthesizing the medical record and then identifying gaps in care or next steps in treatment. So in clinical medicine, this is really exciting. Tinglong and I have actually submitted a grant application to look at how well generative AI can perform in synthesizing a patient with type 2 diabetes, a medical history prior to the assessment and plan of the note, and then interpret the patient's current clinical assessment and identify next steps in treatment. And this could potentially be evaluated for clinical outcomes, how it addresses clinical inertia of, you know, the delays in intensifying treatment of diabetes meds and statins and blood pressure meds. So the innumerable opportunities. But I think that this form of AI is what most of us are have used more recently in our experience with AI. And it's really mind-blowing how well this can really mimic the human human speech and human text. And that's why I think its adoption has been so high.
So basically, you know, there's an additional Russian doll, right? Inside deep learning, you open that one up and then you get generative AI. When we were planning out this podcast, Tinglong mentioned a talk that he had heard at a meeting. The speaker had used a picture to illustrate the differences between traditional and generative AI. Generative AI looked at the picture and it told us what it was. It told us that it was Patrick Mahomes being tackled by a player on the Buccaneers while throwing a pass. Meanwhile, traditional AI looked at the same picture, but could really only identify parts of the picture, like a glove or a face mask, cleats or a helmet. It could tell us that something on there was a Nike logo and that the jersey was probably from the Chiefs, but it couldn't string those items together into a complete thought or really connect the dots. You could say that traditional AI has just not reached the developmental milestones that generative AI has.
Broadly speaking, this is what predictive AI does. It does classification. Well, it does more than classification, but I would say 89% of what predictive AI is essentially classifying things. Is this a cat or is this a dog? Is it Nike or is it Adidas? Is it football or is it soccer? Or is it a lacrosse? But it doesn't really connect things. And also more importantly, it does not necessarily give you outputs for scenarios it's not trained upon. With Gen AI, you have richer outputs, which make it especially useful for healthcare settings.
Do you think that generative AI will eventually be used to expand data sets? So for instance, let's say you have structured data from a clinical trial, but you only have so much of that. And it's really not enough because it's structured data, it's not imaging, to do a sophisticated deep learning analysis. Do you think generative AI could kind of pull in things that are applicable and make that data set bigger? Is that in our future?
Yeah, absolutely. I think AI, generative AI, is already being used to create synthetic data sets that can augment existing data that we have. You know, like in the diabetes space, you can create, you know, thousands of phenotypes of different patients with type 2 diabetes on different meds and different lab parameters that could be then used by another machine learning algorithm to predict some kind of outcome. So it can fill a hole, can also really help out a lot in like semi-supervised learning where you have some of the things labeled and some unlabeled. So yes, I think one of its contributions is in generating data that would then be used to develop predictive analytics.
In pain medicine, there's a distinct and well-known overuse of procedures and historical misuse of drugs. In fact, you know, one of the first things that Dr. DeBacula had taught me in clinic was therapy stewardship. So being able to figure out which patients are going to respond to which procedures and therapies is critical to creation of value. Precision medicine with the help of AI may be the saving grace for the specialty. It may also help us make it clear to insurers when and why procedures or therapies should be covered. So what are your guys' thoughts about this?
Yeah, I see potential in this area, Mustafa. I think you know, there is, like in diabetes, there's not a one-size-fits-all approach. Some patients respond better to certain drug classes than others. And for reasons we don't fully understand, sometimes patients don't respond in the way we expect with certain drugs. So, for example, the GLP-1 receptor agonists that have gotten a lot of hype the last couple of years and are being used for weight management outside of diabetes. It's interesting that, you know, some people, despite being on the very highest dose, have very little effect on their appetite and they don't lose weight. And we don't know exactly why that happens, but you can imagine that AI could, you know, leverage large, vast data sets in the electronic record to kind of predict who is likely to derive the most benefit from a specific drug class. And so then, you know, your question about implications for insurance coverage, I think, are important as well. We could, you know, provide very concrete and data-driven justifications to the insurer about why certain drugs are justified for specific patients. But again, with the caveat that we need to make sure that we have good representation in this data set and there's no biases being introduced in the inferences, because if you have flawed decisions because you have an underrepresented group of people in your AI algorithm, then it can actually be counterproductive, again, even on the insurer side, like of not paying for a certain therapy in a certain group of people because there was insufficient data from that group in making the model. So I it's an exciting area. I think it does have potential to kind of optimize, resource allocation, move towards a more personalized approach to care in various conditions. And diabetes is one, I think, which is a great use case for it.
It's actually, there's a almost comical case or example with United Health. I'm sure you guys might have heard about this, yeah, where they were using an AI model to deny coverage. And it was something like a 90% error rate. So what's going on with that?
That's exactly the case I was about to mention, is that, you know, when people use algorithm, when people use AI, people really think about how accurate they are. I mean, in addition to the bias issue, I think bias, of course, is very important, but even the fundamental quality, people do not think too much about it. You know, do they really work? How accurate they are? And even if they are accurate, that accuracy may only just reflect what's good on the paper, what's only for the training process, not necessarily for the real world. So this again, this back to the point of real world validation. But more importantly, I think this really connects to the issue of automation bias. So whatever is generated by a machine tend to be treated seriously. People tend to think, well, because this was generated by an AI model, it must be correct.
That brings me to my next question, which is about liability with AI. So let's say, and this has happened, you know, let's in radiology and other areas, but AI can tell a clinician to do something. And the human might then acquire a bias where they think the AI algorithm is right, because we're telling them AI can detect patterns that the human brain can't detect, on and on. And then what if the clinician is hesitant to believe themselves?
This is a really critical question. I just want to follow up before I get into this a little bit more about what Tinglong was commenting on, because it is sort of related to this liability question. I teach a course at Hopkins to first year medical students in clinical informatics. And one of the sessions in this course involves validating ChatGPT's clinical decision making for some semi-real type 2 diabetes cases. And at first glance, when you read the assessment and plan of these notes, you're really struck by how believable it is. And it is so convincing in the way that it is actually stating what the assessment is in the plan that you may be inclined to just say, okay, accept and do it. But when you look very carefully and you crosswalk the recommendations against guidelines, there are some fundamental gaps still. I mean, these have not been trained against standard of care guidelines, and they're not performing at the level of an expert clinician quite yet. You can easily be misled. And so this dovetails, I think, into this question of liability. So you have this tool in clinical care. It seems good. It's been validated. I should accept whatever it says as truth. And there might be more harm if I don't agree with it. And so this question of liability was actually raised at a conference that was held by Harvard Medical School in October of 2023. This was called the RAISE Conference, Responsible AI for Social and Ethical Healthcare. And they were talking about all aspects of AI in healthcare. And, you know, the case law is still developing on this topic in the world, but their recommendation was that the clinician ultimately remains legally responsible for medical actions and decisions, even when AI is used. But as AI in healthcare becomes more and more adopted, they argue that tech companies should assume some of the portion of this legal liability if some AI system results in patient harm and they're at fault, right? So you told me to do this, I believed you, I did it, and then the patient had an adverse outcome. So what type of informed consent will have to go into telling the patient, like, I'm recommending this for you, but I'm recommending this for you on the basis of this AI tool too, and it's imperfect, just want to make sure you're aware of that. That'll be interesting to see how that evolves in medicine. But, you know, I mean, I think at the present time, it's the clinician is ultimately still legally liable.
Yeah, so I just want to you know, bring up the distinction between autonomous AI and assistive AI. So if AI functions as an autonomous device, makes independent diagnosis and all decisions, then in this case, it's AI creator that will be responsible for any malpractice lawsuits. But if it's assistive AI, in this case, AI really just helps physicians make the decision or help them write a note, help them decide the right treatment plan, then it's, as Ness mentioned, in this case, the physicians will be the ones who will be responsible for the errors. And so the liability question is very, very important, because if we do not handle this very carefully, we could create a situation that in which the physicians may be using AI only when they think liability risk is low, right? But the value of AI really lies on, it helps us make sense of ambiguous situations, tricky cases, rare cases, situations that we couldn't make sense just on our own. So that if we do not handle liability carefully, you could actually deter physicians from using AI when and where they're actually needed.
I can definitely see how this could be a problem. For instance, in pain medicine, we use a lot of imaging to guide our procedures. And let's say we get to a point where ultrasound machines and C-arms and are equipping us with AI guidance, telling us where to place the needle, for instance. You know, recently I've been asked to go to the ICU for patients who are having refractory VTAC. And these are, you know, code situations, and they want us to go there. The patients are often on dual antiplatelet therapy. You know, they're on anticoagulation. There's a very high risk here. And, you know, I've thought about this. You know, we can't always get there right away or fast enough. What if you designed an AI-guided ultrasound machine that just showed the clinician, so a cardiologist or an internal medicine doctor, whoever was there at the time at the code, could just go ahead and place the needle, you know, and they would be able to do it without us actually being there. And would that save lives, or would that, you know, cost lives? Because what if it tells you to put the needle in the wrong place and the human body is different? This goes back to diverse images and diverse data sets. But are you really going to get the diversity to account for all of the variation in anatomy?
Yeah, that's a really fascinating question. So you're saying, like, using the AI to kind of extend your workforce, so to have skills being picked up by people who don't normally do them. And I could envision aspects where internists would then pick up more procedures that are currently delegated or relegated to specialty care, for example, like a thyroid nodule biopsy. The thyroid's so superficial, and it if the machine was, you know, user friendly enough and accurate enough that you could train somebody easily to do it, you could address like shortages in clinician specialty care and access to specialists in this country. I do think there are already examples of AI assisting in procedures in various domains in GI and cardiology, and probably in pain management as well. But it's interesting about whether, you know, like testing how well it can be used by non-specialists, like people don't normally do it, is an area that I think would need to be investigated.
You know, we're talking so much about the promise of AI, but if I went to ChatGPT right now, specifically ChatGPT-3, and I asked it to write a paper for me, and it gave me citations, and it looks amazing, and I would really trust it because it looks great to, you know, the amateur eye. But if I went to the citation in the DOI, it's actually not a real paper at all. And this is something that is called, you know, hallucinations. So what exactly is AI hallucinations, and how does it kind of play a role in how we go about it?
Yeah. So, I mean, hallucinations is making up stuff that's not real. And that's a great example. and one that is really dangerous because it's almost believable. It seems like it's supported by fact, but if you're not careful enough to check the citation, you wouldn't recognize it and you'd make a decision based on faulty facts. And actually, one of the earliest court cases related to this, I think, was of an attorney who referenced some case law and like referenced the case that didn't exist. And he was, I think, disbarred. So this extends beyond just like the citation for the supporting evidence. It's my understanding is it's less and less as the technology is evolving. And I will say, having used 3.5 and 4 myself, there's less of that in the 4.0 than the 3.5. But it's a real issue. And one that I think needs to be measured. And we are actually designing a study now with Tinglong, with the grant I had referenced earlier, to try to measure that, right? So like look at these clinical notes in diabetes and have it come up with an assessment and plan and actually try to quantify how many times it's a complete lie or made up information.
Geoff Hinton said that, well, people actually are making up stuff all the time. And if you are telling the truth, you just may happen to be making up the right stuff. So in that sense, ChatGPT does not behave very differently from what we do. But just as importantly as Ness has alluded to, is that just like if anyone tells you the reference, tells you certain things, you would verify. We should also do the same to Gen AI, because we know that whatever they generate might not be reliable. So the other part is that if you're using GPT-3, it hallucinates a lot. So GPT-4, it does not hallucinate as much as GPT-3, but also depending on the kind of setting you use, you could specify to what extent you want your AI models to be truthful, to what extent you want to be creative. There's a parameter called the temperature, and you can specify if you try to develop Gen AI applications. So the variety of tools we can use to manage, to mitigate impacts of hallucination, but just keep in mind that it's not the worst thing that could possibly happen. The worst consequence happen as a result of how we manage Gen AI. If we just take it for granted, we always think it's true. If we do not set it up correctly, that's when the biggest problems can arise.
One related topic to this is, you know, whether generative AI should be open source, right? There's been a lot of attention now in the media with Elon Musk suing Microsoft and Rikus for, you know, arguing that this should be for the benefit of humanity and not for profit. And there are examples already of companies that obviously are for profit and have developed AI tools where the claims were not true. It didn't do what it said, and it cost a lot of money. Like one example is this Babylon company. They had developed this AI chatbot for clinical care in the UK, and it was like widely adopted by the national health system, and it ended up just not being true. There were a lot of complaints from patients about its safety, and the company went bankrupt. And there was a recent paper in Nature arguing that for us to really safely deploy generative AI in healthcare, these models should be open source, and that healthcare systems, as stewards of this data, have a sort of an ethical and moral obligation to ensure that profit is not getting in the way of the goal of improved health.
Interesting. You know, I feel like this could be applicable to medical journals who make you pay this open access fee. It is profits getting in the way.
Don't get me started on that one.
So Tinglong, you mentioned a Nature paper just now, but there's another Nature paper just published in 2023 about a foundational model for retinal imaging. And it's very exciting. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So this paper you talk about is one published last year by a team from University College of London. what they did was that they built a so-called foundational model for medical AI. So this foundation model really builds on retinal images. We know retinal images have been used to predict variety of diseases, but mainly eye diseases such as diabetic retinopathy. But what they have done here is just remarkable. They got 1.6 million unlabeled retinal images. And so what they did was self-supervised learning instead of traditional supervised learning approach used to train most of AI models. So you could predict both eye diseases and also systemic disorders such as heart failure. So this is really just the beginning of things, and we expect to see more of such foundational models using one type of images without labels can predict multiple diseases and can even make sense of just general health status of the human body.
Yeah, and I think you told me before, you know, this is sort of a preliminary work, but there was a different paper in which they were looking at retinal images and being able to predict sex.
AI models can sometimes reveal patterns that actually new and to humans, and no humans or no science can make sense, at least so far, why one could actually tell the difference between a male and a female patient just by looking at the retina image. But that's precisely what AI models can pick up.
It's really incredible, you know, and this comes back to, it doesn't always make sense. Like, why would you even think to investigate that relationship? A human wouldn't think to investigate that relationship, but AI comes up with it. And that's what's really fascinating and exciting about AI.
So if we're going to start implementing AI in clinical practice, is it reimbursable? And how are medical practices going to afford to implement it?
Yeah, AI is indeed reimbursable in certain contexts. At least for the last several years, it's been reimbursing. CMS has been reimbursing for some AI technologies, mainly in the image-based area. And so one example in diabetes is the IDX DR retinal camera, which diagnoses retinopathy from fundus images. But there's others like, CT annotation of brain images to identify, you know, acute a stroke or, you know, occlusions. And, you know, this landscape is evolving rapidly in the United States. I think what is clear is that in order to be reimbursed by an insurance company, the AI technology has to have demonstrated clear value. It has to be FDA approved, shown to improve patient outcomes or some aspect of healthcare efficiency. And it'll be, I think it'll be interesting to see where the insurance companies draw the line in this area. Like, some stuff is clearly diagnostic support, software to interpret an image to make a diagnosis, like radiology, pathology. Some you could envision some AI technologies that's leveraging like wearable device data. Maybe they don't reimburse interpretation of that, like data from your Apple Watch or your Fitbit, or embedding clinical decision support, you know, within the EMR to the clinician. You know, is that just helping them make the right choice? Is that really something that can be reimbursed, even if the tool actually has demonstrated improved outcomes compared to not using it? So I think we'll have to see how this plays out. But there are AI technologies already being used clinically, and the insurance companies are paying for it.
There seems to be every decade or so, a time in a clinician's life that they have to adapt, right? So we went from paper charts to electronic charts, and everyone had to adapt. And now no one can live without electronic charts. And I think that this is sort of that next wave. So you either learn how to use it or collaborate with it, or at least understand how it's coming up with what it's coming up, or you're going to get left behind. So I think this is a really crucial episode for clinicians and people in healthcare.
Tinglong, I think you had another slide in one of your classes where you had a quote about being left behind if you don't pick up AI. I don't remember the exact quote. I don't know if you remember it off the top of your head.
I don't remember. I have too many. I like quotes. I'm a quotes person. I have too many quotes. But one of the things I think could be probably relevant to this audience is that it's far easier to create the future than to predict it. It's actually hard to see where this field is going, but everyone is an active member of you know, everyone is influential. Everyone, you know, your role will be very impactful. Whatever you do, that will shape the future of AI and medicine.
Yeah, I completely agree. I really enjoyed this discussion. Thanks so much for having me. I agree with what Mustafa said. Like I've been in, started medical school in 2002. So it's been a little bit over 20 years. And this is to me the biggest and most meaningful change in my practice. And I think the implications are not just for improving patient care, but for improving my quality of life and my well-being, to make me a better doctor, to improve outcomes for my patients. So I look forward to coming back in like a year and seeing how far along this discussion has moved. I think this is going to, you know, evolve pretty rapidly in the next couple of months.
Yeah. And I mean, I think there is one thing we didn't touch on today that I think could be, you know, a topic for a different discussion entirely, but cybersecurity and protecting, you know, data privacy with AI. So I don't know if you guys have any final thoughts on that or anything else that you think we maybe should have discussed.
The data privacy is a really important topic, probably a whole nother talk. And that meeting that took place in Harvard in October kind of brings up recommendations in this area. And like one solution that's been put out there is like patients need to opt out of having their data be used, but there are implications in this opt out process in terms of bias as well. Like the person who chooses not to share their data is then not included in the data set and the algorithm is negatively impacted. So it's a whole other topic, but you know, it's a concern for patients consenting to have their data be used in this way and finding the right balance of leveraging data to improve outcomes while ensuring privacy is going to be challenging.
So that privacy and cybersecurity concerns actually the reason that hospitals are not willing to share their models with each other, to learn from each other, because the promise of so-called federated learning is that you share your machine learning model without sharing your data. But that's not true, because people have shown that in many cases, you can actually infer the original raw data through that model. This is particularly the case for Gen AI, and there are many cases you could show that with a prompt of, with the right prompting technique or with the wrong prompting technique, you could actually recover original training data set. So that's clearly unacceptable for healthcare organizations, and which has tons of valuable patient data that you cannot afford to lose. You cannot afford to just give away to any random person. So that's definitely one of the things that will be shaping the future of AI. But that should not become a reason for us to be scared or to be hesitant. We should insist on adopting. Well, we should insist on rigorous testing and trying and learning, because that's the only way for us to figure out all the risks.
I can imagine that there are certain cultures who would tend to opt out more than others. For example, my parents, I'm of Indian descent, my parents would definitely opt out. I just know it. And so you're leaving out, certain cultures or certain populations. And I'm wondering, you know, just how that could potentially play a role in perpetuating certain biases.
Yeah, I was surprised by the recommendation of this group to even suggest this option of opt out. I think when you're using data from clinical medicine, if it's not complete data representing all of your people and people have the choice to share or not, that variable of choosing to share or not is now a variable that's influencing the model. And I can't see a way forward with AI in you know, using EHR data where that strategy would be meaningful or the model would be informative. And you know, if there are factors that influence your decision to opt in or opt out, that are related to the outcome that's trying to be predicted by the model, then you can imagine that you have a really serious confounder of not including the data.
Yeah,
not to mention you could trigger a vicious cycle, and because people are not included in their training data set, so the model has low quality, low predictive accuracy for that particular subgroup, but that would make the distrust for the model
even greater.
Yep. Even greater. So they end up, so they're less likely to be part of the system, right? So eventually you could create a problem, that's very hard to fix.
So fortunately, Tinglong, I found the quote. I took this picture on September 25th, 2021 in your class, and it says, AI will not replace physicians, but physicians who use AI will replace those who don't. So, essentially we're in this predicament where we need to learn or we're just going to be left behind, like Mustafa said. So thanks guys again for being here. I think that this conversation is so valuable. Thanks Mustafa for co-hosting with me, and thanks to the American Academy of Pain Medicine for this podcast. We'll see you next time. Thanks again for listening to this episode of the Pain Matters podcast. If you have any questions about the content that we covered today, or if you'd just like to continue the conversation, please tweet us at AmerAcadPainMed. That's AmerAcadPainMed with the hashtag PainPod. If you like what you heard, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating and review on your podcast player to help us reach and educate even more of our peers in pain medicine. Until next time, I'm Dr. Shravani Dabrakala, and this is the Pain Matters Podcast.
Thanks for listening to the Pain Matters Podcast. If there's anything we mentioned in today's show you missed, don't worry. We take the notes for you at painmed.org/podcast. If you're not already a subscriber, please consider pressing the subscribe button on your podcast player so you never miss a future episode. And don't forget to leave us a rating and review to help us reach and educate even more of our peers in pain medicine.